I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. House Democrats have outlined a new plan to withdraw all U.S. troops from Iraq by the fall of next year. But the proposal also sets certain benchmarks that must be met, or the soldiers could come home even sooner. It's unclear whether the plan could help address the difficult issue of Iraq, or whether it will divide lawmakers and prove embarrassing for the new Democratic leadership. Some lawmakers argue Congress should not micromanage the war. Others say last November's election was a clear mandate from voters to end the war as soon as possible. New York Democratic Congressman Steve Israel is a member of the group known as the Conservative Blue Dog Coalition in the House. He's been on record supporting a troop withdrawal, but without a timetable. And Congressman Israel, are you on board with this new plan?
I am. And let me just caution you that the language is a work in progress. We're still developing consensus and making sure that the diverse range of views in the Democratic caucus are reflected in the finished product. So what may be on paper today could be history tomorrow. But the concept, I think, is a very good one. It's a responsible and thoughtful one. President Bush wants $100 billion to continue an endless, open-ended involvement in Iraq. Instead of just passing these blank checks and rubber stamping the president, which is what the Republican Congress did for the past 6 years, we are going to use his request to pivot to a strategy that makes sense. We're going to require benchmarks to be met by the president and the Iraqi government. We're going to end participation in an Iraqi civil war. And we're going to make investments where those investments are critical, like Afghanistan, where the real war on terror began, and funding in veterans' health care, making improvements in Walter Reed, which unfortunately was an embarrassment for our veterans.
Okay, let's talk about a couple of specifics first. How about benchmarks? When you talk, and I understand it's a work in progress, but what are the ones that you feel strongly about that you feel should be should remain in the legislation?
Sure. Well, first of all, our own readiness. We are fatiguing our forces. Our troops are doing absolutely heroic work despite an absolutely failed and underfunded and thoughtless policy by the administration. We have to improve readiness. And so one benchmark is, are our forces ready to for their deployments? Do they have the right equipment? Have they rested for a sufficient period of time? The second benchmark that I want to see is on the Iraqi government. I want to see benchmarks on the security of Iraqi forces. I want to see benchmarks on sharing oil revenues, and I want to see benchmarks on their own political issues. Are they integrating Sunnis into mainstream life in Iraq? I have been waited for 4 years. I have tried to give this administration the benefit of the doubt. And 4 years later, it's worse than ever. There have not been benchmarks, and that's why we've got to have this accountability in this resolution.
Mm-hmm. Security of Iraqi forces, that benchmark, what would that mean?
I want to see the Iraqis give us a plan for enhanced and accelerated training of their own personnel, whether it's military or police. I want to see what kind of proficiency they have. I want to see what kind of professionalism they have, so that when we do leave Iraq, we're leaving it in the hands of people who can enforce basic security needs.
You also mentioned this measure would talk about making some critical investments, particularly in Afghanistan. It sounds as if there's a real concern on the part of lawmakers about what's happening in Afghanistan. Can you explain what this legislation does in terms of that concern?
Sure. Look, my district in New York is about 40 miles from where the Twin Towers used to stand. I lost over 100 constituents in my congressional district. That plot was hatched in Afghanistan. If the President of the United States asked me today to support a surge of troops in Afghanistan, I would readily support it, because that's where the war on terror began. And in fact, as a result of Iraq, we have lost our focus on what's happening in Afghanistan. The Taliban is resurgent. Osama bin Laden is still on the loose.
Congressman Steve Israel is a Democrat from New York. He was commenting on the legislation proposed today to withdraw U.S. troops from Iraq by late next year. Well, Washington is still buzzing about this week's guilty verdict in the case of Vice President Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby. When asked about a possible pardon, President Bush said he'll stay out of the Libby case until the legal process has run its course. Libby's lawyers are seeking a new trial after he was found guilty of lying during the investigation into who leaked the name of undercover CIA operative Valerie Plame Wilson. New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof has written extensively about this, and he's called on the vice president and the White House to answer some questions. And Nick Kristof joins us to talk about this case, as well as about his writing on other issues like the sex trade in Cambodia and genocide in Sudan. Nick, let's start with the Louis Libby trial. Why do you think the vice president has an obligation to speak publicly about this?
We had the vice president's closest aide telling the FBI something, apparently spinning fairy tales, at a time when that same aide was riding to work every day, with the vice president in his limousine. And it's sort of hard for me to believe that they never, that the issue never came up, that they never discussed these things. And so at the very least, it's a pattern of highly unethical conduct, and it certainly raises, raises questions about Cheney's role in possibly criminal behavior. And so I just find it very dispiriting that there isn't more pressure on him to speak out and explain himself.
Let's talk a little bit about your reporting and your role as an advocacy journalist. In your comments about Vice President Cheney and about calling on him to answer some questions that you think are left unresolved, are you a journalist? Are you an advocate? Are you both?
I'd say that I'm both. I'd say it's less awkward in the case of, calling on Cheney to answer questions. If people will periodically walk up to me and say, it's great the way you're campaigning on this, or what a great crusade. And I always flinch a little bit at that word crusade, because to a journalist, you think of yourself as a reporter, on issues like Darfur or like sex trafficking. I do sometimes feel that myself walking this fine line where I want to call attention to these issues. I desperately want more to be done about them. The victims are incredibly real to me because I've been out there, I've talked to them. If more people die, they're people I know. And yet, I do feel a little bit awkward about the whole notion of a crusader.
So when do you cross the line, or feel like you could cross the line, from journalist to advocate?
I mean, one of the ticklish issues is always when you kind of step into the arena. And one of the times when I did that raised a lot of eyebrows and a certain amount of criticism was a few years ago when I ended up buying two teenage girls from a brothel that had imprisoned them in Cambodia. There was a sense that it was sort of unprofessional for a journalist to go around buying human beings, even if it was a good thing for those people. Maybe if I'd been a straightforward reporter, I wouldn't have done that. As a columnist, I felt a little more freedom. But really, the thing that moved me to do that was that on an earlier reporting trip, I had been in Cambodia. I had been reporting on it, gone into a brothel, and had spent a long time talking to two girls in particular, one 14 and one 15. And they had been, one had been sold by her stepfather to the brothel, the other had just been kidnapped off the street. And I spent hours with them, got to know them, like them. And I walked out of the brothel knowing that I had this great front page story and that they were going to stay behind and end up dying of AIDS. And it felt very unfair, and it felt like I was just one more guy going in and exploiting them. When I went back as a columnist this time, I really didn't want to that same thing to happen again, to go there and get some great columns out of this that people would say are terrific and it might win prizes or whatever, but end up leaving the subjects of those columns to die of AIDS in the brothel. So that was really what led me to do that. And is it weird? Absolutely.
Do you regret it?
No, not at all. And I just got an email a few days ago that one of those girls, Trainette, she's several months pregnant now and expecting her first baby. She's married this terrific guy. She really does have a new life. And it feels unprofessional, but it also feels really, really satisfying. And there, the same thing arises in Darfur. You come across somebody who's been shot. Well, what do you do? Do you just stand by and take notes and wait for them to die and report it? No, you have a vehicle, so you put them in your car and take them to whatever kind of awful medical facilities may be available. it's not always easy to figure out how you do that, and there is some danger about having people, local people, in your car, because maybe it can make you seem like you're taking sides if you run into bad folks, but you can't just leave some kid to die because you think that it's important to be neutral as a journalist. There, neutrality is important, but saving lives is also important, and you know, you try to juggle those roles.
But aside from, say, certain life-threatening situations, there's also more of a probably more common instance of the day-to-day writing about what's happening and deciding exactly how strong you're going to be in a particular position. I'm wondering when you're doing that, exactly how far you feel you can go before you've crossed a line.
It's sort of funny because when I got the column gig, I felt like a bit of a fraud because I'm naturally not a particularly opinionated person. At a dinner party, I'm, you know, not the one who's running around foaming at the mouth and pounding the table. Because I've spent most of my career as a reporter and seeing, you know, 12 sides to every issue, I tend to see things to some degree in grays. One of the problems is that grays don't really make great columns. You know, they need to be opinionated.
Right.
And so it may be to some extent that in a search for things that I have strong opinions about, I've had to go to the other end of the earth, to places like Darfur, because when you get to Darfur and you talk to mothers whose kids have been tossed into bonfires because of their tribe or skin color, that's not something that you feel wishy-washy about or that there are a lot of grays about. That is something that you just feel utterly outraged about and you want to jump up and down. I don't feel any need to pull punches on that passion or on the outrage that I feel when, for example, governments don't do enough to stop genocide.
New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. He's talking about his role as an advocate journalist. When we come back, we'll discuss Nick's recent trip to Ethiopia with former President Jimmy Carter. The former President Carter is working on eradicating some life-threatening diseases there. We'll also talk about the changing media landscape that has Nick trying his hand at being a video journalist. And later in the show, we'll look at what some businesses are doing to prepare for the potential outbreak of avian flu and how, after years of silence, an autistic child reaches out and communicates with his mother. Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We're back with Nick Kristof. He's a columnist for the New York Times and champion of social issues like stopping the human sex trade, genocide in Sudan, and disease in Africa. And Nick, you recently went to Ethiopia with former President Jimmy Carter, and you reported on illnesses that devastate whole villages there. The New York Times website posted a video of your journey, and here's a clip of President Carter talking about river blindness in Ethiopia.
Not only are more than 1% of the total population of Ethiopia completely blind, but little tiny children that have river blindness have itching that's almost unbearable. The people get tired of scratching themselves with their fingers, so they get stones and pieces of wood to scratch themselves, and they scratch all the skin off. And the skin turns, looks like a leopard spots. And then after a while, the microfilaria go through the body and attack the eyes and cause complete blindness.
That is former President Jimmy Carter talking about river blindness in Ethiopia. Can you tell us a little bit more about that particular story, Nick?
Yeah. I've been trying to figure out ways of writing more about public health issues because as I try to diagnose what we in media do well and what we do poorly, it seems that one area we consistently drop the ball on is public health. I'm going shortly to Afghanistan, for example, and yesterday the ambassador from Afghanistan was saying that 4,000 people a year now die from terrorism, from violence from the Taliban. Meanwhile, I think he said 17,000 women die every year in childbirth there. And you look at today, 30,000 children are going to die around the world from the effects of poverty. It's just part of the backdrop. But if, 30,000 children were massacred somewhere, it'd be an incredible story. But we just somehow don't manage to cover things that kill every day. We only really cover those that kill occasionally. So President Carter just appealed to me as somebody who has really tackled these kinds of health issues incredibly intelligently, very cost-effectively. He's helped put public health issues on the agenda as a human rights issue in a way that I think is very smart and absolutely right. And he's been in the news so much, about his book, but his real impact on humanity is these public health initiatives. Because of him, guinea worm, which has been around probably for about as long as humans have, is going to be wiped out. It's an incredible achievement, and I wanted to give him his due and to just give readers a bit of a window about what it's like to live in rural Ethiopia when you face these kinds of scourges.
Are you concerned? I know we talked a little bit earlier about the line again between advocacy and journalism. Are you concerned here that this story is very much in favor of former President Carter and his efforts in Ethiopia and in Africa? Not to diminish them, certainly, but they definitely are cheerleading what he's doing.
Yeah, no, that doesn't bother me. Since I am a columnist, my job is peddling opinions, and normally we tend to peddle opinions that are full of denunciations of people, and I think it's useful to balance that with holding up people who we admire and who are doing the right kind of thing. If I'm going to slam Vice President Cheney one day for obfuscating his own involvement in the Libby case, then another day I want to applaud what former President Carter is doing.
And we played a clip of this story about former President Carter's work in Ethiopia, and it's a clip that the New York Times is running on its website where you're almost working as a television reporter, even though you're a print columnist.
Yeah. I think that's true. I feel a little bit like, an ancient primitive fish, trying to crawl onto land and trying to develop, limbs and lungs, because we recognize that we have to evolve, especially if I want younger readers. Then I've got to do things differently, and I've got to figure out ways of connecting with them. A lot of that is going to involve video and blogging and just a more casual style. So I was the first blogger in the New York Times, and I've been experimenting with video. I'm not very good at it, but I do think that it is one way of connecting with people who wouldn't otherwise see it. And also, it is, frankly, at times it's incredibly effective. If you have video, then, wow, it just grabs you emotionally in a way that a printed column never can.
It's also sometimes more difficult and can impede information gathering. And speaking as someone who has to record people's voices, sometimes people don't want to be recorded.
Yeah, and there, in Iran, I managed to get detained twice, and I think that was really largely because of the camera, that the camera kind of attracted attention and made me stand out, and I probably wouldn't have gotten arrested if it hadn't been for that. And it does complicate things, but wow, the impact that you get from sound and from pictures, really makes up for it.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicholas Kristof. He's a columnist for the New York Times, and he's been talking with us about his role as a journalist, advocate, and now video journalist. Well, while reporters at the New York Times and other newspapers are being asked to go in front of the camera, Supreme Court justices are fighting to keep their proceedings off camera. At a House budget hearing today, Supreme Court Justices Anthony Kennedy and Clarence Thomas presented a proposed 2008 budget. And Justice Kennedy made an impassioned plea to Congress to give up on the idea of putting cameras in the high court.
If you introduce cameras, it is human nature for me to suspect from time to time that one of my colleagues is saying something for a soundbite. Please don't introduce that insidious dynamic into what is now a collegial court. Our court works. We teach by having no cameras that we are different. We are judged by what we write. We are judged over a much longer term. We're not judged by what we say.
Right now, only audio recordings of some Supreme Court proceedings are released. The justices today also pushed for higher salaries for federal judges, noting that former Supreme Court clerks can make more money in their first year of private practice than the justices themselves. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The World Health Organization's pandemic alert system is now at phase three, meaning that avian flu can only be passed from human to human on a very limited basis. When the alert hits phase five, the virus will be able to start to spread among humans, which could eventually threaten millions of people. Right now, the flu is transmitted mainly from animals to humans. It has killed 167 people worldwide. Governments are working on plans to treat people in the event of a pandemic, but there are many unanswered questions about the handling of basics such as groceries, gas, or phone lines. Joining us to talk about what corporate America is doing to prepare for a possible bird flu pandemic is Karen Dye. She's Global Business Continuity Director for Sun Microsystems. She helped write her company's avian flu preparedness plan. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you.
Also with us is Aaron Desmond with the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Welcome, Aaron.
Hi, thanks, Deborah.
Karen, let's start with you. A recent survey said that many business leaders don't seem to be considering how a pandemic might affect their bottom line. Has Sun Microsystems determined what might happen to its business?
We always prepare for worst-case scenario. So when we were looking at our preparedness, we assumed that within a matter of weeks, we would not be able to manufacture product because we are dependent on suppliers from outside the United States.
And you have about 36,000 employees worldwide, is that right?
That's correct, and we're over in over 100 countries.
But I read that about 21% of Sun Microsystems employees work primarily out of the office. So you do have a lot of people who are able to work remotely, and that is obviously the nature of your business. Do you think that makes it somewhat easier for a company like Sun Microsystems?
Our work-from-home program is over 10 years old, so therefore it is already embedded into the culture, and that gives us a great advantage.
Aaron, what about companies that are not like Sun Microsystems? I read, for instance, that Exxon will try to keep some refinery workers living in plants. How will companies that don't have a lot of employees who work from home keep going in the event of a pandemic?
For some businesses, I mean, the bottom line is you can't. You can't make cars from home. So the question is, if employees are going to come into work, how are you going to ensure their safety? And so companies are looking at a variety of options, and they're looking for guidance as to what decisions they should be making. For example, should they be distributing antivirals such as Tamiflu or Relenza? Should they be distributing masks or respirators to their employees that might come in during a severe pandemic?
Karen Dye at Sun Microsystems, how is your company dealing with those kinds of questions?
The antivirals, this requires a prescription. Sun does not have a medical doctor on staff, so therefore we did not have that as an option. We also felt that from an ethical perspective, it was appropriate for the antivirals to be available to healthcare workers and other organizations where this would be more critical. So we did not want to access a limited supply of antivirals. The other thing, too, that is an issue with that that companies need to consider is, who do you give these to? Is it just your essential employees? Is it the families of those employees as well? As far as the personal protective equipment, we are letting the individual regions determine the need for that, and that is more from a cultural perspective. For example, our Asian office has already stockpiled masks and gloves.
But what about ensuring that those essential workers will be safe, those workers that have to come into the office instead of being able to work at home or just stay at home?
I don't think anyone can guarantee the safety of anyone. We have already identified the essential employees that absolutely need to be on site. For those people, we have policies in place as to how they might accept a package at the front door. If they come into the workplace, that they are more than 5 feet away from each other. So we have plans to restructure the workplace.
Aaron, does that make sense to you, that the companies concentrate on hygiene and different preventative measures in the workplace rather than do things like stockpile antivirals because those should go to emergency workers first?
Not only is it potentially the right thing to do to make sure that antivirals are available first to emergency workers, but it could potentially be the mandated thing that happens on a state or federal level. If a state of emergency is declared, if a company has a stockpile and the government's going to come in and confiscate it, that probably wasn't a very wise investment. But the baseline thing is, first of all, addressing the issue, identifying some of these key areas, and communicating to employees, because the bottom line is, during a pandemic, a severe pandemic of influenza, it's going to be tough. And there may be severe shortages in critical products and services, and there may be severe shortages in terms of the medical care, in terms of the expectations that we have.
Karen, you've done some drills, I understand, to try to get ready in case of a pandemic. What did you learn from those drills?
We learned that communication is key. And our first exercise included Bangalore, India, Singapore, and then the U.S. And the terminology, we had different interpretations and definitions of some of the terms that we were using. So that was key. Also, for us anyway, it was very critical that the majority of the decision-making be made locally, because from a corporate perspective, we don't have a handle on what is going on at the local site. The other thing, when we originally developed our plan, we had used the World Health Organization phases as triggers as to when we would implement certain action items, and we learned that on a local level, they may implement some of those activities sooner and before the World Health Organization would go to the next level. And I think that's what's important, that each company, it's going to be different for each company as to what is absolutely we must continue so that our business will be a viable business.
Aaron, what's your advice to companies grappling with all of this?
First of all, don't give up. Second of all, I think the best first step is to try to become informed on the issue and some of the practical things that you need to address within your company. And when we think about government and their role in this, government doesn't make stuff. When it comes down to the essential products and services that we rely on every day, it's coming from the private sector. And so when we're looking at preparedness for an influenza pandemic, that's why it's so important for businesses to address this issue and decide what the appropriate measures are in their circumstance to be prepared. And when they do that, a part of that consideration is going to be connecting with local public health authorities. And sometimes that means picking up the phone and helping set the agenda, because your local public health agency might not be accustomed or understand the needs of a business and what are the bottom line things the business needs to know to help in their preparedness plan.
Aaron Desmond is with the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. We also spoke with Karen Dye, Global Business Continuity Director for Sun Microsystems. Still to come, a mother and child reunion after years of separation from autism. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, it's that time of year again. The NCAA tournament is about to begin with the selection of the 64 teams that will vie for the title of the best team in college basketball. Conference tournaments have done some of the paring down, but NCAA officials will spend the rest of the week figuring out the 34 best at-large teams to match up with the so-called anointed. And then they're likely to spend the next week hearing everybody complain about it. Here to talk about the coming March Madness is our sports
You're
guy.
Mad already, Jess.
I'm mad right. already. Is Bill Littlefield joins us now. Bill, it's good to see you again.
It's great to be here.
So I guess the smart money's on the Florida Gators repeating here. Are we in for the usual wild ride here until we get a winner? What's up, Bill?
Well, first of all, there is no such thing as smart money when you're talking about money bet on the NCAA basketball tournament. You know, anything can happen. An 18 or 19-year-old can call a timeout when the team is out of timeouts and then go on to have a fine career in the NBA. A coach can go nuts and cost his team a technical foul, which ends up resulting in a foul shot that loses the game. Anything can happen in the NCAA tournament. Upsets really are the rule, especially when you get deeper into the tournament past the first round. So, yeah, Florida has as good a chance as any, except that they won last year, and it's very, very hard to repeat.
Right. And same for the women?
Well, the women's tournament has become more and more interesting as the years have gone by. You know, back in the old days, everybody has said lots of times it was either Tennessee or Connecticut, and you could count on one of those two teams winning. Last year, neither Connecticut nor Tennessee even made it to the Final Four. Maryland was the winner. So, you know, there are all kinds of different teams that have a shot, and that's part of what makes that tournament such fun. The other night, Rutgers upset UConn. See Vivian Stringer, the longtime Rutgers coach. Maybe it'll be her year to finally win the NCAAs.
A lot of maybes. Recently, Bill, you spent some time in Pittsburgh. One of the stories you're featuring on your show, Only a Game This Week, is you're catching up with the basketball team at Duquesne. They won't be going to the tournament. It's been quite a season.
No, they won't be going to the tournament. They lost twice as many games as they won, but the fact that they fielded a team was somewhat remarkable. Back on September 17th, early in the morning of September 17th, five members of that team were shot after a dance as they were walking away from a confrontation, trying to avoid a confrontation. Happily, all five young men are physically fine. The most seriously injured may not play basketball again, but even he has returned to practicing with the team. But the incredible story from a basketball standpoint is that Ron Everhart, a first-year coach at Duquesne who went over there from Northeastern, had to put out a kind of an open casting call. And at one point, the coach of the women's team said, you know, I know this kid who's a freshman here. He was a pretty good basketball player in high school. Why don't you take a look at him? I mean, this is the way the guy assembled his Division I basketball team.
Wow.
So the fact that they won 10 games and they got to the Atlantic 10 tournament was quite something. And if what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, that is one team that's going to be very strong next season.
Mm-hmm. What about professional basketball? Dallas Mavericks have already clinched a playoff.
Yeah, they've only won 51 of their first 60 games, which kind of makes it a little bit unfair. The great story that's left for Dallas is how well does this team do once the playoffs begin? Based on their track record so far this season, you'd have to say they do very well.
Right. And we didn't have time to fit this in last week, but it is International Women's Day after all. And you're a big soccer fan. Your comments on Mia Hamm and Julie Foudy being elected to the National Soccer Hall of Fame.
Well, the most striking thing about Mia Hamm's election to the Soccer Hall of Fame was that four people didn't vote for her. I don't know whether they were asleep or whether they haven't been paying attention. Mia Hamm, of course, was the face of women's soccer during the gigantic soccer boom, you know, the 1999 Rose Bowl full of fans. Two worthier candidates, it would be impossible to imagine.
All right. Well, good news. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Bill Littlefield joins us just about every week to talk sports, and he hosts NPR's Only a Game each weekend. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Amid the stories of possible miracle-like breakthroughs in dealing with autistic children is one mother's tale of how, after 9 years of living with an uncommunicative son, she finally was able to connect with him. Portia Iverson suddenly discovered the person inside her son's body as he typed out his feelings about everything, including what it feels like to be autistic. Portia tells this story in her new book titled Strange Son, Two Mothers, Two Sons, and the Quest to Unlock the Hidden World of Autism. Here and Now's Alan Cockle spoke with Iverson and her son Dove and has their story.
Portia Iverson and her husband John Shestack are Hollywood types. She's a writer and set decorator. He a producer whose credits include the Harrison Ford thriller Air Force One. They live in a big house, a former convent, in the Koreatown section of Los Angeles. Portia remembers when autism first intruded on this life, the day when she realized that all was not well with her infant son, Dove.
Well, he seemed pretty typical as a baby until he was about one. And then something strange started to happen. Like, I'd come in the kitchen and, you know, sit across from him. He's in his high chair, and I'd say, "Hi, Dove," and he wouldn't look at me, and I noticed him staring at something, and when I turned to see what it was just flickering patterns of light.
By the time he was three, it was clear that Dove was severely autistic. He couldn't speak or point, and he'd spend hours in the repetitive rocking and flapping behaviors known as stimming. Frustrated by the lack of effective treatment, Iverson and Shestack formed an advocacy organization, Cure Autism Now. They raised money and lobbied Congress. They started an autism gene bank and worked to bring good scientists into the field.
But when we came home at night, here was Dove, still nonverbal, still as autistic as ever.
When Dove was 8 years old, Portia learned about Tito Mukhopadhyay, a remarkable 15-year-old autistic boy in India. Like Dove, Tito was completely unable to speak, and he had all the autistic behaviors, the lack of self-control, the hand flapping. But Tito's mother, Soma, had taught him to communicate using a pencil and a hand-drawn keyboard. With her constantly prompting and refocusing him, Tito could tap out words. He even wrote poetry. Iverson said she was skeptical at first, but her doubts evaporated when she met Tito. Believing he could be a window into the disease, she arranged for Tito and Soma to visit the U.S.
What I wanted to know was, what was it like to be inside his head for about 3 seconds? What did the room look like? And the first time he ever gave me an answer to that question was so exciting. He described watching water running from a tap into a blue bucket. And he described, you know, for about a page and a half, in great detail visually how this looked.
She took him to see neuroscientists who found that Tito could see or hear, but never both at the same time.
And then he started to write on the next page, but there's also something else. It's a sound, and it sounds like water, and it sounds like water running into something. It's something bigger than a teacup, and he went on, and I realized, my God, even though he just told us what it looked like, he's now describing the sound, and he seems to not know what it looked like while he's hearing it.
So he can't integrate the two.
Right, and the senses were so split apart. And then finally, after a while, he gets to the color blue, and this bridges him over, and he's able to put it all together.
Was Tito one in a million, or could Soma's approach help other children? Iverson asked her to work with Dove, even though it could take years to teach Dove something as simple as putting on his own shoes.
So I didn't have a lot of hope, but Soma began seeing Dove once a week for 30 minutes. And after six of these sessions, one night the aide said, "You've got to see this. Dove is pointing at this letterboard and he's typing out words."
In the 1980s, an approach to autism called facilitated communication became popular and controversial. It involved a caregiver or facilitator who would support the child's hand as he typed. Many kids seemed to benefit, but some studies found that the facilitator was subconsciously guiding the responses. "This approach is different," Iverson says. "When Tito and Dove type, no one holds their hand or directs their typing. The key seems to come from the constant, rapid verbal prompting that continually refocuses their attention. Dove is now 14. I asked him how he felt before he learned to communicate."
Okay, now I'm holding up Dove's board, and you're going to hear me ask him to rest his left hand.
Okay.
Rest your hand, Dove. And use his right hand. You'll hear me do a lot of different little prompts.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Dove, you ready? Put this hand down. Pick this one up. Go ahead. Tell us how. Come on. I. Go ahead. F. Keep going. E. L. T. Come on.
I felt terrible, he wrote. I said, is it better now? And again he typed, because I don't feel so sad. Dove, what would you like to tell people about autism?
Okay, you can take your time on this. Are you ready? Here, I know you're nervous, but stop. He's just like swallowing a lot of air. Here, come on, pick up your hand. Yeah, come on. What do you have to tell people? He wrote P. Go ahead. L. Keep going. E. A. S. E. Please. You're doing good. Come on. Come on. Leave that alone. All right. Frustrated. Keep going.
The letters came slowly. Please just realize that we are intelligent. And there was more.
Now, just think. Imagine if someone's listening to the radio and they're listening to see what you have to say. W. Keep going. Yeah, he's listening. Come on.
I'm listening.
E. C. A. N. Keep going. Look, Dove, look. Keep going. U. N. You're doing really nice. D. E. R. S. Come on. T. Come on. A. N. D.
We can understand.
Yeah, he's just sort of stimming for a second here. Okay. Here, finish up. Now remember, Alan is listening to you and you're going to be on the radio. So what was it now? T what? H. I. N. Look. G. Period.
We can understand everything. Please just realize that we're intelligent. We can understand everything.
Right. Please just realize we're intelligent. We can understand everything. Is that right? Is it right? Yes or no?
Yeah.
Okay.
Dove, thank you very much.
Okay, say thanks and say goodbye. Say bye. The day that I first saw Dove typing out words at Selma's apartment was probably the most shocking, upsetting in a good and bad way, but mostly in a good way, probably the biggest thing that's ever happened to me, the most extreme thing that's ever happened to me in my life.
Because on the one hand, suddenly you have access to the son who you've never been able to connect with. But on the other hand, what?
On the other hand, you feel terrible because you realize he's been in there listening the whole time and you've treated him like a 3-year-old. But at least I know that he knows that we understand him. We know that he's intelligent. We know that he has feelings. And he knows that we love him. We know that he loves us. But I would say to parents, basically, if you have a kid and they can't say I love you, it doesn't mean they don't love you.
Iverson hopes that Dove will one day go to college. To help him and others like him, she's established a school, a website, and links with researchers. She believes as many as half of nonverbal autistic children could learn to communicate. No, I
would not give. Here and Now's Alan Cockle spoke with Portia Iverson and her son, Dove. Iverson's book is Strange Son, Two Mothers, Two Sons, and the Quest to Unlock the Hidden World of Autism. For more, go to our website, here-now.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.